Vacation rentals, it's a problem across the state. There are estimates that the number of illegal units is in the thousands. To some, it's a way to supplement income. To others, it's a source of nuisance complaints, and others blame the units for changing neighborhoods and contributing to the problem of our housing crisis. Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell last week announced his plan to tackle the problem, which has been festering for close to 30 years. The bills he's introduced allow for bed and breakfast units in all neighborhoods across the island while cracking down on whole home rentals with stiff fines. Some call it draconian.
If you're operating a single-family resident, unoccupied, no owner there, your fines start at $25,000 a day, going up to $100,000 a day. So pretty soon your fines are probably higher than the value of your home. We also have an ability to disgorge any profits. So if we find out you've been doing this for a while, we just caught it, any profit you made from those rentals, you have to pay back to us. In addition, liens can be placed on the property. Execution actions can be taken, and the property will be taken away from the owner for violating. So heavy, draconian type of fines to send a clear message to folks that you need to comply with the law. Get their registration number, abide by the rules and regulations, you're okay. If you don't, we're going to find out sooner or later. We're going to have people checking social media sites. We're going to probably retain a third party to help us do that, yes? Find out and come after you. Bright line, clear. We don't want to grow our bureaucracy. The guys at DPP, Department of Planning people here, are overwhelmed with work. We're not asking them to go out and do more inspection work than they already do to help them deal with that issue. The omnibus bill, should it be passed by the council, and I hope the council does act on these bills and does it quickly before the end of the year, before the start of the next legislative session, because the legislature will probably be taking up this issue too. And they're going to be looking at issues about who's going to collect the tax. And we're not opposed to folks, these platforms, collecting the tax. But we want to make sure we know when you're collecting the tax, you're collecting it from legal operators, not illegal operators. And so we'd like to get this done before the end of the year, before the legislature goes into session. And should it pass, the effective date of the omnibus bill will be May 1st, 2019.
Airbnb declined comment, but it's a member of Travel Technology Association, which issued a statement saying it fears the measures would overregulate the industry. It pointed to a study conducted by Cloninger and Sims at Commission, which included data from Expedia and Airbnb. It estimates that without alternate accommodations outside of resort areas, Oahu could lose $1 billion in economic activity. But community groups are pushing back. They want to see enforcement first before any expansion or legalizing of bed and breakfast units or additional transient vacation units. We sat down with Chuck Prentice with the group Keep It Kailua.
We're really taken aback because it has been raised a number of times and has been defeated each and every time. And now it's being brought up again. And that's a big concern for us because we very strongly oppose bed and breakfasts. They are proposing that they be legal everywhere, and we're strongly opposed to that. And they're also proposing that transient vacation units, the TVUs, that they be allowed in every apartment area up to 1% of the number of dwellings in the development plan areas. So that's that island-wide, they're talking up to 3,500 TVUs, and that's a serious problem, especially our apartment areas. Some of the associations don't allow it. I think some of them don't even know whether they allow it or not, to tell you the truth. And also, residents will just ignore it, and you've seen where there have been some examples of the residents and the association having to go to court to try to resolve the issue. It's going to be, I think that's going to cause more problems than it's worth.
And I know the concern for some folks has been the enforcement.
Yeah, that's a big issue for us, is the enforcement. All along we've been agreeing with a number of the other organizations like Sun Hawaii and others, and the first thing that has to happen is better enforcement. The enforcement now is it's quite a joke. You know, we have some examples of how they inspectors tried to enforce and what the results were. Also, the number of inspectors is very, very low, inadequate. And it's all tied in with not only the inspectors, but the procedures and the tools that they have to enforce. And just about everything they have, well, we know it hasn't worked because of the terrible proliferation of all these vacation rentals.
Well, the mayor's been making some reference to possibly a third party.
Well, they're proposing to hire a company to check online for all of the advertisements, which initially is a good idea. But they're going to be checking for the permit number, which is another good idea that we support. So they'll be looking for the permit numbers. And if someone advertises without a permit number, then they could be subject to a violation. But if you don't have a permit number, then it's very difficult to identify who you are, because Airbnb and some of those organizations don't release the address of the property until after you submit a deposit, after the client submits a deposit. So there's no way of knowing by a third party sitting behind a computer to know where these things are. So that's totally inadequate just to do that. The mayor has also said they're not going to increase the number of inspectors. Well, that's one of the problems. They're going to have the same number of inspectors, and they're going to have thousands of permits that they're going to issue. And there's a lot of restrictions on those permits. For example, the owner has to be living there. Well, when you look at a permit number on a computer, how do you know the owner's really living there? Right now, we have owners who say they're living there, and they don't. So there's no way they're going to be checking that, especially without more inspectors. Little things like, these are just examples, separate entrances. They don't know whether, you're not allowed to have a separate entrance for a B&B. You have to go through the front door, so you're part of the family. That's the whole idea about it, and that's the legal requirement for it. But they don't know whether there's a separate entrance or not. There's one, two doors for me. That it's illegal, has a separate entrance. That's two strikes against it. Also, the number of rooms. They're only allowed to have two rooms for each bed and breakfast, and four persons total. How do they know how many rooms they have? Right? They have no idea. So also the parking, if they say they have parking, they have no way of knowing really whether there's parking or not. So all of these things are just examples of what their proposed enforcement program is really inadequate about.
And you're a longtime Kailua resident. You yes. Remember the whole dialogue in the 80s and the friction that caused back then.
Yes, these things cause a lot of friction among the neighbors in the community. And let's go back to the 1980s. In 1986-87 is when they first added to the land use ordinance that these would be prohibited. And there was good reasons for it then, and there's good reasons for it now. In fact, there's better reasons for it now. We're really shocked because of the housing crisis issue. The mayor and council have repeatedly stated that Oahu is currently facing a housing shortage and a housing cost crisis, while at the same time proposing to transform much-needed homes and apartments into these hotel-like businesses. It's a total contradiction. It seems like a movement that is totally opposite from what the needs of the island are. One argument that the mayor and council member Ikaika Anderson has used is that there are seniors who need the B&B income. But then they're allowing everybody to have a B&B. So why didn't they just limit the permits to those who have the seniors' property tax exemption? That would be a very simple administrative move, which would really not require much enforcement because they know who those people are. So if you got the senior citizens exemption, those people are over 65 years old, then you might say, well, you know, they need a little help. I know here, actually, on the mainland, I've experienced a number of instances where it's a large problem here. I didn't think it was much here, but someone said, gosh, yeah, I already know about one of those. And that's where people have had to either sell their homes or give up their homes because they can't afford the property taxes, especially on the East Coast. And I didn't think it was happening here, but I've heard of at least one experience of that already. So it might make sense to allow the senior citizens to do that.
Okay. So there are a number of things that you like and you think are good things in the mayor's bills, but there are also some things that you're not happy about.
No, the overall idea of making these things legal is, as I say, totally absurd. And they're talking about transient vacation units in apartment areas. And that's the area where we have the most serious housing crisis, is the condo and the apartment areas. And they would even allow vacation rentals in these two- and three-story walk-ups that are the areas that or the units that are most needed by the lowest income people in the community who having trouble, and some of them end up homeless out on the street. It's all related to that, and I just can't understand the thinking behind this whole thing.
So during this process, I believe the mayor's team sought input from various groups. Did you folks in Save Oahu's Neighborhoods suggest ideas?
The representative from the Save Oahu's Neighborhoods was on the mayor's task force. They were aware of our concerns and expressed them. And apparently it didn't do much good. They can't even enforce the rules they have now, and they're talking about increasing the numbers almost infinitely. And so how are they going to enforce it? They can't enforce it now. But I do have some numbers here for the Windward Kolaupoka area. Then this is the numbers that would apply if the mayor's proposal goes through. They say that you can have transient vacation units up to 1% of the housing units in that development plan area. So in our development plan area, we have 36,894 housing units. So that means you could have up to 369 TVU permits in apartments. And all of the apartments in Kailua are within walking distance of the beach. All our condominiums, all our new ones, all our old ones, all our expensive ones, all our reasonable ones, they're all fair game here. When you look at that number, 369 for Kaneohe, Kailua, and Waimanalo, but there's no control over distribution. So one experience we have tells us what might happen. The current distribution, when you take the non-conforming use permits that exist and you take the transient vacation rental units, there are 0% of those are in Kaneohe, 94% in Kailua, and 6% in Waimanalo. So out of this 369 for the whole Windward area, 347 could be in Kailua versus we now have 29.
So your point is that that neighborhood is shouldering then a great deal of the burdens.
And they don't seem to care. They don't have the management to address that issue.
That was Chuck Prentice with the group Keep It Kailua. We're told that the bills that the Kahlo administration introduced are expected to be reviewed by the Planning Commission and the City Council. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Ohawaii. In today's backyard quiz, we head over to the island of Kauai. Millions of years ago, volcanic eruptions created basalt over which a 151-foot waterfall now cascades. Below the ridge, you can see vertical dikes of basalt cutting through the horizontal Koloa lava flows. This waterfall gets its name from the freshwater shrimp that were once plentiful in the Wailua Stream and which would tumble down this waterfall to the rolling water beneath. It flows year-round, usually in a double cascade. But after a heavy rain, the two sides often merge into one powerful gravitational plunge to a pool of water that is inaccessible to hikers, unless you know the trail secrets. So what's the name of this waterfall? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. The lovely intertwining voices and original songs of Kupaua have delighted listeners for over a decade. HPR is honored to present this multiple Hoku award-winning duo in the Atherton Studio on Saturday, August 4th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for Kupaua. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management. The 2018 Rim of the Pacific War Games wrap up this week. The final exercise was a beach assault that brought together ships, aircraft, and Marines from 11 different nations. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty was on hand to witness the operation. He brought back this report.
The roar of two F-18 Hornet fighter jets signaled the start of an assault on Kaneohe's Pyramid Rock Beach. A multinational coalition was about to launch an amphibious landing in the fictional nation of Griffin. Their objective was to retake an airfield that had been captured by hostile forces in the wake of a natural disaster. It was the culminating exercise of RIMPAC 2018. Marines and sailors from Australia, Chile, the Philippines, Indonesia, Japan, Malaysia, and South Korea joined U.S. service members for the assault. Commodore Ivan Ingham was in command of the task force.
For today's demonstration, all of the assets that you see, the Marines, the soldiers, the ships, all the connectors, are all under the command of CTF 176, which is commanded by me. I'm an Australian naval officer. The team, it's a fully multinational team. So on my staff, I've got staff officers from Colombia, Singapore, Canada, New Zealand, America. So we're a Chile. We're a fully integrated staff. And really, we don't look at all of the command responsibilities in key positions across the command structure of the RIMPAC are shared amongst the participating nations. So we're a multinational combined force. All of the different nationalities bring a richness of their culture and their way of doing business, but actually it's remarkable kind of how similar we are. And the biggest barriers to us doing business is communication, is the language. And we're fortunate that most of the participants here have very good language skills, and we have our own arrangements for making sure that we are interoperable, and that's the whole purpose of the exercise. This is the 26th RIMPAC, and the theme for a number of years for participating nations is capable, adaptive partners. And I think those three words kind of capture what it is that we're trying to pursue every 2 years when we get together. Clearly, with such a large exercise, so many ships, aircraft, submarines, so many participants from across the entire Pacific region, interoperability is really key. At the sort of strategic level, the exercise seeks to promote relationship building, cooperation, trust. It's an excellent opportunity for the militaries within the Pacific region to come together and work in what is a really unique and asset-rich environment.
Behind Commodore Ingham was the HMAS Adelaide, one of the Royal Australian Navy's two amphibious assault ships. The 750-foot-long Adelaide can carry 8 helicopters, 4 amphibious troop carriers, and over 1,000 Marines. As the F-18s thunder overhead, two waves of amphibious assault vehicles spill out of the Adelaide. Each vehicle, known as an AAV, can carry 21 fully loaded Marines. Think of a tank that can drive on both land and open water. In this exercise, 300 Marines will launch towards the beach from Indonesian and Australian ships. Lines of AAVs already fill the bay, churning through choppy water. As the first troop carriers reach the sand, attack helicopters escort them from above. The back ramps drop, and teams of U.S. and Malaysian Marines pour onto the beach.
Go, 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 go.
Get that 32 up, get that 32 up.
Get on.
U.S. Marine Colonel Michael Stiskel commands an international task force of Marines and aviators based in Hawaii who specialize in operations like this one. He oversaw the ground and air portions of the mission.
What you saw here today was a demonstration of amphibious combat power coming ashore, a combination of surface assault and air assault, and then all of the other assets that we would use in an operation like this. So what you saw was some preparation of the battlefield with aircraft, and then assault amphibian tractors, the AAVs, come ashore, and then we'd be doing assault follow-on echelons with other assets. This is a very complex operation to get ships and Amtraks and aviators and planes all into one spot in a very tight area. So we've been planning this for a number of weeks, and at the end of the day, I think it went very well. And all of the countries participating today, I think, learned quite a bit. As a maritime exercise, if we look at the Pacific, the Indo-Pacific theater, a lot of littoral areas where we might have to work from the sea and then go ashore and then come back. So this exercise really demonstrated the flexibility and the inherent utility that we have to a combined force. So 3 days ago, we executed operations off of Kauai, and then within overnight, we were executing operations on Bellows Beach, and that was within a 24-hour period. So we can lift and shift our assets fairly quickly as opposed to a strict land force where it just can't be as flexible. So today I have 9 countries here today, or 11 countries operating today on this operation. I think we showed some strength. If we try to do it all separately, we wouldn't be as effective. So, but with the Indo-Pacific theater, where majority of it is water and you have to get ashore at some point, the ground and the sea is definitely going to come together, and the aircraft just give us longer, different reach, you know, so we can get out and help people, or we can get out and affect the enemy or an adversary more effectively.
But there was more than just naval power on display. Soldiers from the U.S. Army were participating for the first time. In fact, it was the Army that carried out the largest amphibious assault in history, the D-Day landings at Normandy. But for RIMPAC, they're in a supporting role. Colonel Christopher Wendland commanded the Army's portion of the exercise.
So if the Navy wants to go a certain place and they want us to make sure that it's unhindered for their movement, we're from the shore, we're going to provide support, whether it be long-range artillery, long-range air defense, or other means that we might have, electronic warfare, to provide an opportunity for them to get to that area that was denied to them.
And so you're providing support to both the ships at sea and the Marines on the beach?
Absolutely. We were nested with amphib assault, so we would do preparatory work, prep work. And then the same thing with the Navy, as they were trying to transit certain areas that may have been contested, we would do preparatory work as well to make sure that they can get through those areas, all from the shore. And it's working the interoperabilities. How well can the Army support the Navy as they want to be able to go someplace? How do we enable them?
And so what did you think of the exercise now that it's over? How did it go?
I think it went extremely well. I'm glad that we got a chance to work with the Marines and get to work with the Navy to kind of complement each other's capabilities or strengths, and complement those weaknesses that might have had to, with our strengths, to enable to make this a successful operation.
The F-18s came around for a second pass as landing teams secured the objective. Their commander, Colonel Stiskel, gave his assessment as only a U.S. Marine can.
So our planned H-hour was at 0920. We hit the beach at 0919. So in that word, we made it 1 minute early.
From Marine Corps Base Hawaii, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
RIMPAC 2018 concludes on Thursday. The exercise included 26 nations, 52 ships, and more than 24,000 military personnel. To listen back to our coverage of this year's exercise, head over to hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Missouri University of Science and Technology, offering distance graduate programs in engineering, science, technology, and business for military personnel. Learn more at military.mst.edu.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Nathan Eagle joins us with more on a story about poll results, new poll results for the governor's race. Hi, Nathan.
Hi.
So what do you have for us?
Well, we've got some pretty surprising results. We've got Governor David Ige with a huge, like, 15-point swing against Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusas since our May poll to the July one. He's up about 43% to her 34%.
Now, I know you're focusing today on the governor's race, but you've got poll results coming out all week, right?
We do. So stay tuned for those.
Yes. And so what do you think brought about this shift?
Well, the responses I got from different political analysts were kind of across the board. Some were saying, you know, it's the missile alert strategy that Congresswoman deployed. It kind of lost steam a little bit. They kind of suspected voters might have wanted a little bit more. Others say that Governor Ige has actually started ramping up and his message is getting out. And so they're like, oh, okay, he is running. So a little bit of everything.
Now, I know, I think it was this weekend, we saw the newspaper throw their support behind Colleen Hanabusa.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big endorsement for her.
Right, but your poll happened before then, so it'd be interesting to see what happens at the voting booth.
That's exactly. Yeah, we were in the field July 19th to 21st.
And so you folks also did a breakdown, too, of the results, you know, with different groups. Tell us about that. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So Governor Ige's was really buoyed by Japanese-American voters as well as moderates. We saw huge swings there in support for him. You know, going from in May, he had like maybe a 2 percentage point lead against the congresswoman among Japanese-American voters. And then you look at July, he's got 55% to 26%, you know, almost double. More than double, actually. And then a similar kind of flip with moderates and conservative voters really coming out strong, making up their minds, I guess, who they want to vote for.
And what about the age grouping?
The age was interesting. Congresswoman did better among voters under age 50, and Ige did a lot better with those over 50.
And so we'll see who turns out in a couple of weeks.
That's the big question, is who will actually show up to vote, how many will come out to vote, and then, of course, voting is already happening as we speak.
Right, and then we've seen lots of stories about different groups, you know, endorsing one candidate or attacking another on their record.
Yeah, and I expect that'll just continue to ramp up between now and Election Day. We were just going over some of the filings that have been coming in terms of, like, how much money they're going to be pouring into those campaigns between now and Election Day.
Okay, and then you folks also looked at the Republicans in this race, and I understand that you still have some forums that you'll be holding prior to the election.
That's right. Yeah. So we did pull the Republicans in the race. We had State Representative Andrea Tupola up with 39% over former state lawmaker John Carroll at 22%. And then, yeah, so tonight I'm going to go over to Kauai and check out the governor's debate there, one of the last ones that we've got on the books. And then Wednesday we have our fireside chat minus the fire featuring Governor Ige.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Nathan. Well, hopefully people get out there and get to know the candidates.
Great. Thanks.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Earlier in the show, we asked you the name of a waterfall located in the Wailua River State Park on the eastern side of the island of Kauai. It's a spectacular 151-foot waterfall whose name comes from Hawaii's native freshwater shrimp. Many of us know these shrimp as opai, and if you know the Hawaiian word for rolling, you probably got the answer to today's quiz. Opai Ka'a Falls is the name we were looking for. Our listener who submitted this quiz says one of the best times to see the breathtaking falls is in full sunlight when the water just sparkles. And maybe you'll even catch a glimpse of the little opai. Now, that is today's quiz. And, oh, we can tell you that we do have a winner. Apparently, we got lots of calls from across the state, but the winner is Michael from Manoa. You got it right. Again, that's today's quiz, and if you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The magic of a native Hawaiian chant, what's called an oli, is remarkable when you look at the broad range of emotion it covers. HPR's Noe Tanigawa shares some insight about the cultural practice.
You know, it all happened because Dr. Kalena Silver was being honored by the Moanalua Gardens Foundation. He's the second recipient of their Namakahelu Oli Award. So it was a terrific chance to talk with him. Dr. Silva's called one of the greatest chanters of his generation. He's a scholar. He's the director of Kahakaula o Ke'elikolani, the College of Hawaiian Language at the University of Hawaii at Hilo. So he's a kumuhula as well, a musician, scholar of Hawaiian language, and he wrote a really fascinating article. I'll let people link to it from your conversation page. That it was featured in a New Zealand publication, where he talked about oli and its history here. And he said, you know, Hawaiians believe that language, especially when it was chanted, had mana to it. And he said he can't think of any traditional activity that did not have chanting that went with it. He says almost, in fact, at one time or another in their lives, every Hawaiian, I'm going to read here what he says, expressed, affirmed, and influenced the course of his or her life through the mana of language, which was given focus and direction by oli, by chanting. Can you imagine?
It's like, pretty incredible. It's powerful stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's like people saying, all right, let's focus our attention here and making things happen using their words, right? That's how contemporary New Age people say it these days. But anyway, Dr. Silva said that, you know, Hawaiian chanting, way different from Western singing, right? I mean, it just sounds different. He says it's more in your head. And he noted similarities. He's an ethnomusicologist as well. He noted similarities between some Eastern European singing, even some singing in the Southern U.S. that's kind of got this sort of nasally sound to it. So, Catherine, let's hear the chantress. She was the last chantress of Moanalua, and she's the person for whom this Moanalua Gardens Foundation Oli Award is named. Her name is Namakahelu Makaena, and here she's doing a chant. It's called a Ho'ai'ai. It's a poetic chant specifically about the longing for a loved one. In this case, it's the longing for a child who's grown up and moved away. It's It's interesting to even think of the sentiment, right? I mean, children, you lose contact with children for different reasons, but when a child has grown up and moved away.
Yeah, there's still a little bit of longing for my baby.
Even though they're fine. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that Oli were used for, to capture emotions of all different types. And it was a little harder to hear in this cut because of its age. This was recorded in the late 30s, maybe 1940s. It's sort of a humming or buzzing song that goes along inside the vocal part of the chant. Dr. Silva said it's called Hano, and it's kind of a humming sound behind the actual audio. I really would like to see if you can hear it. Here's Dr. Silva. He's delivering a chant in the Olioli I'i style. It's from pre-cook times, and so it's got a lot of long vocal lines and quite a bit of a vibrato. But this one honors the 19th century Queen Emma and her genealogical, spiritual, and cultural connections to Mauna Kea. Interesting. Yeah.
The vibrations and the sinus cavity.
I know. And, you know, when at the Mamua, at the Prince Lot Festival, it was amazing how these sounds can cut through the air and really bring people together. And that's what they were used for, you know, in ceremonies or all kinds of things, but as well as kind of colloquially and just getting together and talking to each other. And there's another type of chant where people, they were called kanikau, and they were dirges about loss or grieving, and hundreds of these were published in Hawaiian language newspapers over the years. They're personal songs reminiscing about loved ones, and they're very individual. A wife might write one to her husband and reminisce about that time we were caught in a rain squall on Kailua Beach, or when we were picking mokihana up Koke'e that time. And so it gets very personal, and they're so beautiful when you read them. I'd like to let you hear something that the very first recipient of the Namakaena Oli Award, Kaupena Wong, is chanting. He is the teacher. He was Kalena Silva's teacher, a master chanter currently living in Waianae. Kaupena Wong here offers a chant and the translation for a very special Molokai lament.
What will become of Hawaii? What will leprosy do to our land? Disease of the despised, dreaded alike by white or brown or darker skin. Strange when a man's neighbors become less than acquaintances. Seeing me, they drew away, they moved to sit elsewhere, whispering, and a friend pointed out a finger. He's a leper. I bowed my head. I knew it was true. In my heart, I hugged my shame. Prisoners, we were marched aboard. Victims of leprosy, branded for exile. Abandoned, cut off from family and dear ones. We were left alone with our grief, with our love. Rain of tears streamed from leper eyes. Leopard cheeks glistened with raindrops in the sun.
I'm telling you, this is not something you're going to get very many places. I'd be happy to supply the link to this sound file as well.
Really chicken skin. Oh, my gosh. Very powerful.
The ways the chants were used were so amazing. And one interesting thing that Dr. Silva said in the last part of our conversation was that it's changing so much coming into the present. It doesn't have a lot of the qualities that the older chants do, and he wonders how chanting Oli is going to be brought into the present day. It could be through this more conversational sounding. I wonder, would you like to hear Mary Kavenapukui chanting? Yes. I mean,
yes.
I thought it was so interesting. Let's hear her. Here she is in a drum chant, the drum by Patience Namakawigan Bacon. Really a different feeling, huh?
Very different.
A
very
different,
very
sense.
Different. Where did you get these recordings? These are fabulous.
Oh, I've just been looking all over, and it's been great. It's been so fascinating, and I must say that Kaupena Wong has been an NEA fellow, a National Endowment for the Arts fellow, so his work is really well documented as well. And there are many, many chants from history that have been recorded, but some of the recordings are not as, I mean, they're kind of scratchy and stuff, but it's just, you can get a sense of it. And what Dr. Silva's concerned about is how it goes into the future. You know, and he says it's going to change because the Hawaiian language speakers that they're developing there, you know, through his school there at UH Hilo, they want them to be a part of the world today. So he says there's no way the chant is going to be different. I want a little taste of that. I thought it would be fun to hear the Mary Monarch 2018 Miss Aloha Hula, Shalia Kamakaokalani, delivered this chant during her kahiko performance. You hear
very
some
different.
Of that more full-throated, right? Wow.
Very different.
We don't know where this is all going to go, but But Dr. Silver says the ability to converse in Hawaiian, just the use of Hawaiian language is such, you know, it's like, it's wonderful. It's nourishment for his ears when he hears it. But the use of language with its full kauna, with the metaphors, with the layers of meaning, with the allusions to history as well as contemporary life that people were able to pack into their chanting in the old days, you know, that's a level of verbal interaction that we don't really do that much, even
right.
in English, right?
Right, yeah. But the whole page unwritten for all the... Thank you, Noe Tanigawa, for spending time with us.
Oh, hey, thank you. Thanks so much, Catherine.
Last week, we featured a story that shared the high drama caught by, of all things, a plant cam. Now, when a large tree fell in the forest up in the Waianae mountain range, it almost obliterated a rare plant that the camera was fixed on. That plant was believed to be one of less than 200 left on the planet, so when the large trunk sheared the plant, scientists sprang into action. It was akin to a 911 rescue, and scientists are now nursing a branch of the rare specimen at the Lion Arboretum in Manoa. Now, the micropropagation laboratories are a kind of intensive care unit. The new facility, some 7 years in the making, opened just a few months ago. We caught up with its director, Rakan Zawahawi, who will mark his first year at the facility this fall. He was busy preparing for this weekend's open house, which will feature, of all things, tree climbing. Now, he has fresh eyes on a facility that is turning 100 years old and continues to be delighted when he turns a corner and spies something new on the 200-acre property.
That's a really amazing asset to have here, and you can really sort of go back into the back of the valley and get lost, quote unquote, right, in the sense of just being out there in a beautiful landscape. The collections are really unique. So there's a 100-year history here. And over that 100 years, 22,000 accessions have been made. So those are plants or seed or some kind of live material that has been brought in or shipped in to be germinated and propagated here. Of those 22,000, We estimate we have about 13,000 individuals on the grounds, representing about 5,000 species of plants from throughout the tropical world. So that's a really unique set of features there. And whenever I go back into the back of the valley and wander around, always just my breath gets taken away when I round a corner and just see a new specimen that I haven't seen before. So there's that hidden quality to it. And then our work here in the buildings and what's done here, so you have the grounds, you have what we call the Hawaiian Rare Plant Program. That's an incredible program that started about 25 years ago and was started basically to safeguard threatened and endangered species of plants in the state of Hawaii, which, as you know, there are many. And so basically there are two major units to that, the Seed Conservation Lab and the Micropropagation Lab. The Seed Conservation Lab basically stores seed, incoming material. It's kept, it's desiccated, and then put in fridges or freezers, depending on the tolerance level of these different species, and there are about 26 million seeds housed there. And then the micropropagation is tissue culture. So these are actually little test tube plants growing in a growth media because they can't be stored as seeds. So some seeds just don't keep. And so these are tiny sort of mini versions of what the plants are, and they're constantly being vegetatively propagated through time. And this is a holding pattern, right, to keep this germplasm, to keep this material from being lost, because you have all these threats of invasive species and critters that dig up, tiny remnant populations of plants and so on. And so we act as basically a warehouse to hold this material until you create better conditions out in the field to take this material back out, and ideally you wouldn't have this facility, right? So that's another incredible gem of this place. And there's the horticulture department here, which is which oversees all the greenhouses, propagates plants for planting out into the arboretum for our plant sales, and so on, creating new hybrid lines. And then there's the education department.
This facility is named for Harold Lyon. Did a remarkable job when you think, 100 years.
Yeah, I think he would be very happy to see where it has come. The objectives of what needed to be done here were quite different to what we're doing today, obviously. Back then, you had a lot of deforestation that happened here, a lot of erosion was going on in the watershed, and he was hired to arrest that, to find a means to slow that process. And so his immediate reaction as a forester, and it seems simple today, but I think, in many ways he was very innovative in that, was to go and start doing field planting trials. And he quickly found out that using native species, because they grow so slowly, was not going to address the problem in the time frame that they wanted it to be addressed. So he turned to more vigorous species from mainland tropical areas. And so that's why we have so many exotic species, some which are infamous today, but the albizias being one of them. But they, their initial purpose, why they were planted here, was very different, right? He was the one who, before passing away, he helped, deed it to the university and wanted it to be kept as a botanical garden or an arboretum, and that's sort of how that transition happened. And so it went from part of the Hawaiian Sugar Planters Association's experimental field station to addressing sort of the watershed issues to then becoming an arboretum. But he never really saw it develop further. Obviously, he didn't see any of these other units that I mentioned just now in terms of the growth that's going on here and how it's slowly become very integrated in the university, which is an area that we really want to sort of grow and foster moving forward.
Do you think he'd be proud?
I think so. I think he would be. I mean, many of the plants that he himself planted are still here today, and they're enormous and just incredible specimens. So, I mean, the ficus, that huge tree that's in our backdrop here, is what's going to be used for the tree climbing event at the Ho'olalea, and these are incredible, huge trees that are breathtaking just to look at.
That was Rakan Zahawi, director of Lion Arboretum. The open house in Ho'olalea in Manoa is this Saturday, with hands-on activities for kids, food vendors, and fun for all ages. Look for a symposium and plant sale later this fall to showcase the research underway to save our native plants from going extinct. For info about what's featured, click for our links on our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
What do hip-hop artists Jay Dilla, A Tribe Called Quest, and jazz greats Herbie Hancock and Miles Davis have in common? They'll all be featured on Friday, August 10th, when drummer Dehan and his ensemble take over the Atherton. Call 955-8821 during office hours or go to hprtickets.org for this genre-crossing evening. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
That's it for today. Tomorrow we'll be talking about the Alawai Canal and taking your calls. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Record your comments. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed a part of the show or want to find a past one, find them on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.